wildlife extravaganza this year. Foxes and mountain lions. Well, let's get started. So it's 11/28/21, and it is after Thanksgiving and before Christmas. And I was in a line of people with their trees in the back of their trucks. I'm assuming everybody is doing that. Rihanna has ADD, so that's been done for a while. She already put up with everything and decorate. I'm like, she does everything ahead of time. But anyway, today is not a very long passage, but a very interesting passage. And I think that we'll discover that we are going to deal with very revelation type stuff today. So before we jump into that, I want to draw your attention to, we'll go to Psalms 74:14. And if somebody wants to read Psalms 74:14, whoever's fastest on the draw, you'll see why I'm mentioning it here in a minute.
He broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness.
So that's weird. So Leviathan. Okay, so somebody give me, we'll see Leviathan today. So Leviathan is in the Bible multiple times. I'm curious if anybody has a different word like great serpent or dragon in place of Leviathan. I'm just curious about that. It's being used there to represent. So, okay, let's just backtrack for a second. Leviathan's a giant sea creature, okay? Not a real one as far as we know. A mythological one. The description of multiple heads is also the description of a thing called a hydra. So we have a mythological creature here. Now, we have a lot of things like that throughout the Bible. And when we have that, we've got a couple options. Option number one is, maybe it's not mythological. Example of that is giants. They're improbable. They don't make a whole lot of sense, but we don't know exactly what we mean by giants. Do we mean 20 feet tall or 12 feet tall? If we mean 12 feet tall, then there's an extreme likelihood that this could exist. If we mean 24 feet tall, there's a very small likelihood that this could exist. So when we are dealing with something like a word like giant or Leviathan or other hints of things that seem mythological, which we have, here's the thing about mythology. In a lower level of education and a lower level of biblical scholarship, people tend to automatically write off anything mythological, like Hercules or Medusa or whatever. Okay? In the higher levels of more intense, in-depth research, they come back into play. And the reason they come back into play is because the time before Noah. We don't know exactly, heck, even Andy doesn't know exactly when Noah lived. But we have a relatively good idea of relatively when. How can we have a relatively good idea of when the flood occurred? Well, the way we could have that is because after the flood, we would be seeing evidence that was much more rampant of humanity. Prior to the flood, a lot of that, whether it's regionally or internationally, like worldwide, would have been wiped out. the flood itself would have been such a great turmoil that it would have wiped out so many things. Well, okay, that doesn't mean things didn't exist prior to that. It just means they got wiped out like a clean slate, which is great. I'm totally fine with that idea. When we start seeing things like lots of evidence of human activity, that would be an indication that this would be post-flood, right, in general. Now, we don't know. We can't nail it down to an exact year, but 3,000-ish BC-ish. Could be as much as 5, could be as little as 3,000-ish is pushing it. Because right about then is when you start to have all of this information. You start to see all these cultures, see all this evidence of their existence, see writing developing, see all these things that still exist. So it's a kind of a general way of knowing. Well, prior to that, so we're not talking about an extremely long amount of time. If the flood is from, let's say, 3 to 5,000 BC, there's plenty of people before that. Whether we go with Adam and Eve as the first two people, or whether Eden is a special creation, however we look at Genesis, and you can go back on Modern Paladin and look at Genesis if you want to see more of a study about that idea, because it really depends on how you read that first couple chapters of the Bible. If you read it straight, like it's written, then it appears that men and women were created plural in Genesis 1, and then Adam and Eve were created in a special way in Genesis 2, which would indicate they weren't the only people on the planet, which answers a whole lot of questions like, who did Cain marry? But that's not required, because God's God and he can do what he wants. So he could have Adam and Eve have another 47 kids after Seth, and 22 of them could be women, and two of those could go visit Cain. I mean, it's possible, especially if Cain lives for hundreds of years, right? So it is possible to do all that. God can suspend a lot of rules, such as the rules of the way biology works as we understand it today. But anyway, the point is, these time frames are, pre-flood time frames are at the very least questionable. Okay, their exact time frame. But what we do know is there's lots of stuff going on before the flood. Not only do we have Adam and Eve and Seth and all that, and we have, at the very least, we have Cain going off and creating his own kingdom and all this other stuff. So we have all this evidence of something going on. And one of the things that's going on is these angels, theoretically, and coming and breeding with human women, and the creation of all these bizarre sort of mythological beings. We don't know anything about that. We have like literally a sentence, okay? We know it's bad enough that God takes them out and that he has David do the cleanup work with the last of the remnants of that, because something's gone horribly sideways. But we don't have any details. We have no idea how angels and could be with human women, for instance, because angels aren't sexual. Angels are not sexual. They're not married. They don't do that. They don't reproduce. So I have no idea what that even looks like, or why that would exist, or how that's even possible. Doesn't even make a whole lot of sense. So we don't know exactly how that works. In the scheme of things, theologically, it would make sense, because you could imagine that there are angels, there could be angels that would be jealous of people, because that's where the Messiah comes from, and that's where the great blessing of God lies. That could make angels, some angels questionable. I don't know. Like I said, way out on the edge right now. But that does give us a place in the Bible for biblical existence of mythological things like Medusa or Hercules. I'm not saying they're real. I'm not saying that's a thing. I'm saying we have room in the Bible for some pretty dramatic things like that to occur. The oldest thing that we know of in writing and history of humankind. It's probably the writing of the Sumerians, which is in cuneiform or cuneiform, depending on where you go to school, and the story of Gilgamesh. Now, Gilgamesh is this mythological hero of these sort of Babylonian or pre-Babylonian people. Now, why do I mention that? Because I seem to be very far off the biblical base that we're founded on, but I'm not. And here's why. In Gilgamesh, Gilgamesh goes to see a guy. I'm not making this up. You can look it up. Gilgamesh goes to see a guy who built an ark and him and his family survived. That's in, it's in there. It's in the Epic of Gilgamesh. He goes and visits the guy who made the ark and everything. Now, if Gilgamesh was real or based on a real person, this makes absolute sense. Because if you had a hero who was like some kind of epic level hero, and he was a flood survivor described as having some type of angelic or non-earthly parent, not making this up. It seems like I have to be, but I'm not. Okay? Then you would have Gilgamesh being quite simply a Nephilim, right? And then you would have him being this great, mighty man of renown, just like it says there in the Bible. We don't get much on it, right? And, of course, atheists use this to disprove the Bible. They use this to say, you see, the Hebrews took the story from Gilgamesh, which is older, and just adapted it. And if they're really smart atheists, they say, remember, Abraham was from that region. He's probably passing that down. That's pretty smart. That's pretty smart. That's a good argument right there. But what it doesn't do is explain the flood in the first place, or the fact that there's a guy that survived it. So what we have in the Bible is the backstory of all of that. And so it's like proof, instead of being an antithetical thing about the Bible, it's actually proof of the Bible that that exists within Gilgamesh, because it's another whole culture describing as a side story this flood, which Gilgamesh, of course, survived because he's so powerful. And he goes and sees the guy who packed his family up in this ark. That's pretty amazing to me. That that really exists in real life is just amazing to me. But what does that mean? That means that when we run into, what am I talking about? Because I sound like I'm crazy, but I'm not. What we're talking about is whenever we get the terms, something that's mythological pops up on our biblical radar, or sounds mythological, we've got two approaches. Approach number one is try to figure out if it's real. Approach number two is it being used as a symbol? In the case of Leviathan, it's probably both, but we're going to go with the symbolic use of it primarily. Because as a multi-headed serpent, Leviathan can represent things like kingdoms and empires, as well as evil in the world. This brings us back to the Revelation connection. When the serpent rises up out of the sea in Revelation, is it a serpent rising up out of the sea? Or is that a symbol for the rise of the Antichrist? Does this person look like a man? When they're worshiping the serpent, the dragon, the beast, are they worshiping an actual beast? Or is it a guy? And the beast is a reference to their character. So how do we decipher that? We don't really. We have to use the best we can, brain-wise, to try and biblical text-wise, to try to sort it all out. More than likely, we're dealing with symbols and the personality. Why do I say that? Well, because Lucifer was a beautiful being. Perhaps the most beautiful being that ever existed. Pure light, goodness, and wonder abounded in this beautiful being. But, I mean, the person's named after light. But God doesn't want slaves, so free will. And Lucifer uses his free will to become very bad. Which any of us can do. Anybody with free will can decide to go, you know, rob a bank or kill people or whatever. Right? People do it all the time. He did it in the biggest way possible, right? And proceeded to, you know, destroy everything, get his hands on forever, basically, summary. When he shows up in the Garden of Eden as a serpent, is it a serpent? Now you think to yourself, it has to be a guy, because a serpent would be weird, but would it be weird? I mean, these two people are living alone in this paradise with all these animals, probably talking to them. I don't know if they could talk. I don't know about how Dr. Doolittle-y Adam was, but probably pretty Dr. Doolittle-y. Probably won't hear the term Dr. Doolittle-y much in your life, but there it is. I mean, I don't know. Maybe a serpent coming up and saying, hi, what's up? It's not that weird in Eden. Maybe he's an actual serpent. A serpent would have been an animal. They were surrounded by animals. That would have been less, probably a lot less shocking than a person walking up to them. I'm just guessing. They might have been surrounded by people out there in the world. They might have been able to see them. I don't know. I don't know. So are we talking about that serpent being the same serpent at the end? Probably not. Not that the person was the same, but the serpent look was probably different, right? Because he probably looked like a nice, friendly serpent in Eden. But what we get is this description of a giant serpent coming up out of the sea. Now, that imagery is Leviathan, right? That's what that is. If you go and you look up the description of him with the heads and the horns and the whole thing, that is the description of Leviathan, what a Leviathan is. And we have horror movies called Leviathan about creatures under the sea. And so, and you know, Greek sailors referring to, you know, giant squid or giant octopuses as Leviathan, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that I'm mentioning to you because that's going to be right off the bat. And we'll need to try to decipher what we're talking about. And it's probably not an actual creature. It's probably a symbol for something. 27, Isaiah 27. In that day, the Lord with his severe sword, great and strong. I'm in the New King James Version. In that day, the Lord with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Leviathan, that twisted serpent, and he will slay the reptile that is in the sea. Now, we need a lot more time than we have in this class to try to sort out why this Leviathan is in the sea, okay, and why he's coming up out of the sea in Revelation, and what all that means. We've talked about the ocean before in this class. We've talked about how big and vast and deep it is. How it represents so many different things. In general, one of the things it represents is the great unknown. we don't think about it much as human beings, but God has a thing about the great deep unknown. The ocean we have right here. Okay, not technically here, it's a little ways away, but you know what I mean. The ocean we have right here on this planet, but we also have another deep, great unknown, which is the universe. I mean, thinking about where we really are is a very scary concept for most humans. Thinking about the fact that here we sit in this little room, but that there's oceans out there where you could take Everest and drop them in a hole. I mean, the biggest thing that we can see and exist, the largest mountain, Mount Everest, can be dropped in a hole. There's holes deeper than Mount Everest in the ocean. I mean, we can't even get our heads around that. Like, we can't even start to comprehend things like that. And you stand on the beach, so you're allowed to stand there, and the ocean laps against your toes. What a bizarre concept this is. Just think about this philosophically. You stand on the beach with your little capris on or your shorts or whatever. The ocean laps up against your toes, little bubbly water. It's cute. And you play in it like the first 3 or 4 feet of it, right? And then there's this endless thing that's going on that you can't even comprehend. Same thing with space. We went to the moon, which is a little tiny rock very tightly hugging us. Okay. It's a really, really close. It's as close as anything can possibly be to us, right? We went there. That was a huge human undertaking to go to the moon. And that's just nothing, like literally nothing. That's like going to Jersey, going to Pueblo. We're talking about Mars a lot now. A lot harder, but really, really close. On a social, just the scale of our solar system, it's tiny, but on a scale of the galaxy, it's absolutely minuscule. I mean, Mars and Earth are like as close as the two closest hairs on your body, if your body is the galaxy. Closer to scale, but anyway, I mean, He's got a thing for the vast unknown and deep calling out to deep. And that's because that's also part of God. We have this understanding of God as the one who's with us, protecting us and helping us, which is definitely what God is. And Jesus walked with us, and the Holy Spirit dwells with us. We have a very close relationship with God. But God keeps around us all the symbols of more of who he is. The ocean and space are symbols of God. More of who he is. Like the vastness of the universe, the vastness of the ocean. And we get our feet wet. We might even scuba dive, but we don't go far. So, I mean, Billy Graham and James Cameron are examples of people getting really deep into the ocean. If you understand my metaphor. So why is this great Leviathan coming out of the sea? So we've got a connection of all of mankind based on the sea. The sea was always a big deal. But think about this, and I don't want to get too crazy with the poetic, prophetic speech. But the Sea of Galilee is a sea. But it's a sea that's inside of the Holy Land. It's kind of surrounded by places that Jesus went. Galilee is the sea, but it represents Jesus. It's the sea among men. The Mediterranean Sea is connected to them, but much bigger. But it connects all these cultures together. It's like the core of cultural connection, basically, for the world. of that time. But then you go out from there and you have Atlantic and Pacific oceans. So you see what it's like? It's like growth in the direction of the universe, or growth of Christianity. So that growth is the connector of the whole world now. Back then, it wasn't. In the time of Isaiah, oceans were barely known. In the time of Jesus, they were more known. The Romans were really familiar with them, but only on a surface level, really. Now we're familiar with the oceans as in all of them, as in the Arctic Ocean, as in the Pacific from side to side. We traverse them every day. It's a whole different deal. So in a way, this ocean represents the whole world. The world is mostly water, right? The world's mostly ocean. So it represents that. But there's a million different images I could go through when it comes to the islands floating in this ocean, such as all the land that we live on, all of us. So there's a million more things we could talk about when it comes to this deepness of the sea. But in this sea, or coming out of this sea, is Leviathan. Well, what does that have to do? Well, where does Lucifer come from? Lucifer comes from heaven, from the great vastness that is God. He's a bad version, sure, but that's where he comes out of. He comes out of the greatness and depth of God. Is that what we're talking about? Well, we're talking about the same thing that Isaiah does most of the time. Stuff about right now, and stuff about the big universe, and stuff about the future. And it's all being pulled together. And why do we know that we're still in a time of discussion like we were last time concerning the end time? And that's because we have the code words, in that day. In that day, the Lord, with his severe sword, not his normal sword, evidently, a more severe one. What's the sword? The sword is the word. What else is the sword? The sword is the blade that is used for reaping. What about the severe sword? That's speaking of tribulation. It's great and strong, punishing Leviathan. Now, Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, fascinating, the word fleeing getting used here. Are we talking about the very end time? Are we talking about empires? So let's jump into it a little bit more. Like I said, it's not super long, but it is pretty intense. In that day, sing to her. Okay, well, Leviathan is it a her? Let's hold that thought and keep going. In that day, sing to her, a vineyard of red wine. I, the Lord, keep it. I water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would set briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them. I would burn them up together. Or let them take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me. And he shall make peace with me. Now look at this. This is very poetic and kind of odd. But let's just take a look. So a vineyard of red wine. So we're talking about the symbol that we've had over and over again throughout Isaiah, throughout the Bible, in Revelation. There's a vineyard. There's grapes. Red wine equals blood. We equal grapes. There's going to be a harvest. Okay? The Lord is keeping that vine, keeping that vineyard, protecting it, watering it every day. Our daily bread being watered, whether it's manna, whether it's the Lord's Prayer, whether it's our daily lives, we're being taken care of night and day. Who would set briars and thorns against me in battle? So this, I feel like this is a reference to Revelation when they're trying to attack. And also we get all these continual metaphors about things like you cast the wheat grows, some of it grows, some of it's chaff, sometimes it's briars and thorns and weeds, sometimes it's good wheat. So briars and thorns could be representing bad people. But why would you go up against God in battle? And it says, I would go right through them. I would burn them together, right? So that's really what happens in Revelation's instantaneous battle. Why would you bother battling the Lord? That doesn't make any sense. Or you could be on his side, take hold of his strength, make peace with him. It's much wiser. That last two sentences is kind of strange. That he may make peace with me and he shall make peace with me. Okay. So it's saying it's an option, but what will happen is making peace with him. Those who come, he shall cause to take root in Jacob. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. Now that's a direct reference to Christianity, right? In the root of Jacob, which is a lot of different things, but one of those things is Jesus. Israel shall blossom and bud, which it does, and fill the face of the world with fruit. So fruit, and once again, casting forward into the New Testament, we have Paul's descriptions of the fruits of the Spirit, all the things that we're supposed to exhibit. So over and over again, there is a description of us as a vine or a fruit tree, and we're supposed to show our fruit. So you don't know what kind of tree that is or vine that is until the fruit shows. So this is a symbol for Christians, believers showing their fruit. Who are you? Well, you're supposed to demonstrate who you are through your fruit. Has he struck Israel as he struck those who struck him? Or has he been slain according to the slaughter of those who were slain by him? In measure, by sending it away, you contended with it. Now, this is, like I said, this is pretty intense poetic speech. He removes it by his rough wind in the day of the east wind. Therefore, by this, the iniquity of Jacob will be covered. And this is all the fruit of taking away of sin. When he makes all the stones of the altar like chalk stones that are beaten to dust, wooden images and incense altars shall not stand. I know I'm saying a lot of crazy words, and it's poetic and it's difficult, but it's not. It's Jesus, okay? So what's going to happen in this end time with this fruit of this vine that God's been protecting? Things are rising up against it, but they're being blown away. He removes it with his rough wind in the day of the east wind. I like the reference to wind. If you recall in Revelation, there's angels holding back the winds. The winds are blowing at certain times and not blowing at certain times. And winds are being utilized within Revelation. And the speech is extremely difficult, but it's because it's a very Revelation. Yet the fortified city will be desolate, the habitation forsaken and left like a wilderness. There the calf will feed, and there it will lie down and consume its branches. When its boughs are withered, they will be broken off. The women come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Therefore, he who made them will not have mercy on them, and he who formed them will show them no favor. So we're trying to figure out what it's going to be, all right? Are we talking about a blessing or a curse? If we're talking about Israel, the people of God, which is what we're talking about. We're talking about the location. We've mentioned Israel several times. We've mentioned Jacob several times. We're talking about the people of God. But if it's going to be Israel that we're talking about, it's both. Remember, Israel rises up and is destroyed, and then rises up again and is destroyed again, and eventually will rise up one final time. But it does go up and down. When the people are not paying attention to God, what does it say? It says that when the women come and set them on fire. The people have no understanding. You've got a problem. The fortified city will be desolate. And it shall come to pass in that day. So this is it. This is 27:12. And it shall come to pass in that day. You got both descriptors telling you, pay attention. This is a prophecy of the far future, usually. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will thresh from the channel of the river to the brook of Egypt, and you will be gathered one by one, all you children of Israel. So threshing. Threshing is where you take the grain and you thresh the grain. Okay? This is related to the threshing we've seen before, related to the harvest we've seen before, related to the reaping we've seen before in both Revelation and Isaiah. The channel of the river to the brook of Egypt. Okay. Does anybody have anything else?
Flowing Euphrates to the Wadi of Egypt.
Yeah. So what it is when it talks about the river, we're going all the way back. So I don't know why God chose this place, but we were talking about this the whole class, you know, the beginning of time and Noah and all that, and Abraham. I don't know why God chose that place. And it's odd that in all of our lives, in the very recent history, there's been this massive wars in this same region. We're talking about Iraq, which is weird, because if you talk to a non-Christian or a general young person, the only concept they have of Iraq is this long, endless war that we just fought. That's so crazy that the cradle of civilization, where it all began and all these things, is right there in the same. Look, think about the planet, how big it is. How many billions of acres and how many cultures and all these places. Everything is one little dot? That is so weird. That little dot contains Abraham. That little dot contains, the Tower of Babel. That little dot contains, you know, Eden. That little dot contains the first empires. That little dot contains the first writing of humans. It's so weird. When I teach my wine class, and I talk to the wine class about the fact that the wine scientists have traced all grapes in the world back to a single spot in the mountains of the northern part of this area, where very easily the ark could have landed, where very easily Noah could have planted the grapes, absolutely realistically, bringing the Bible and archaeology and grape science, wine science, together in one basket. In the whole world, there's one little location where all grapes or all wines from the whole world are from. And that just happens to be the same general vicinity that the ark would land. And Noah just, the first thing Noah does when he gets off the ark is plant grapes. And this gets really crazy really fast when you study this archaeology meets the Bible thing. We'll have another update on that soon. But this river, Euphrates, the Tigris and Euphrates River, this is Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. This is where the rivers are. This is the origin place of human civilizations. This is the origin place of biblical culture. And it spreads out from there, and the Holy Land is like this distant place that you can walk to from there, basically, if you have, you know, it takes a long time to walk there, but you know what I mean, through the Fertile Crescent. We're talking about from that river to Egypt, the Brook of Egypt, or That's the Holy Land we're talking about. We're talking about what we call the Middle East. We're talking about the Holy Land. And this goes on and on and on. Where did Cain go? Cain headed east to establish his kingdom, which is what now? Iran. I mean, how ridiculous is that? How are they reading our newspapers in 2000 BC? The only way for any of that to be connected like that is God. There's no other explanation. I would really, really like an atheist wine expert to try to explain to me why that's the exact same place in the entire world. And how ludicrous the Bible is when his whole life is built on it. It absolutely blows my mind. So we also have these rivers drying up in Revelation and armies crossing those rivers. And think about that for a minute. What's drying up those rivers? Where are the armies crossing from? That would be Iran. And it would also be, you could head north to Russia. You could also head over to China. It could be China, Russia, Iran. It could be all of that mixed together as this big army, anti-Jesus army that is going to fail dramatically. But the Holy Land is what we're referring to. So it shall be in that day. Last verse 13. So it shall be in that day. The great trumpet will be blown. They will come who are about to perish in the land of Assyria, and they who are the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mount at Jerusalem. So we have had three or four sentences explaining to us that we're dealing with the end time. The one before that, and it shall come to pass in that day, and then in 13, so it shall be in that day. And we've learned throughout Bible study class for years that whenever something is repeated, to pay close attention. And so here we have a very clear summary of the end time. So it will be in that day. The Lord is going to thresh it out. The people that are good are going to be figured out. The beautiful budding heads of grain that are delicious and golden are going to be sorted. The trash is going to be, discovered. Big piles of that is probably going to be burned. We've got imagery of fire. We've got imagery of the fruit being harvested as well as the grain. We've got a location between Euphrates and Nile, basically. And we even have an exact symbol of the trumpet. We know about the trumpet judgments in Revelation. And here is a great trumpet being blown. And they will come who are about to perish in the land of Assyria. So these are the people that are coming, could very easily be the people that are coming to attack Jesus, because he's on, in that time of Revelation, he's on the holy mount of Jerusalem. But these people, these outcasts, a lot of these people are going to worship the Lord. So you have this time of, how does that work? People that are about to perish, the city's in turmoil, fires and threshings, outcasts, but also worshiping. And that's a pretty good summary of the tribulation. Because in the tribulation, you have people that are ignoring God and then people that are coming to God. There's tribulation saints, the people that come to God during the tribulation. And there's lots of them. And there's the people that do attack and do resist. And this is all taking place in this same area. So we've got a pretty good symbol of the tribulation. And whether that Leviathan is the actual beast from Revelation, because it's a beast from the sea with multiple heads, so it matches, or whether it's representing something else. Now, what would it have meant, and we'll finish up with this, what would have all of this meant to the people of the day? Remember, we're always looking at Isaiah talking about past, present, and future, right? And far future. Well, in the day that they're in, they're dealing with a Leviathan of sorts, which is the Assyrian Empire. They've got multiple heads. They're going in all directions. They're taking over, attacking, and destroying. They're going to attack the city of Jerusalem. There's going to be a problem. They're not going to succeed. So this language also has to do with the time of Isaiah, also has to do with the Babylonian Empire, also has to do with basically every empire. And, of course, we know that's going to be how they're going to be taking it for the most part at that time. But, of course, we know from in that day, the very first words of the chapter, in that day, the Lord with his severe sword, right? And then number two, and then verse two, in that day, right? And then 12, and it shall come to pass in that day, and 13, so it shall be in that day. We had four references to in that day, meaning that we are solidly looking at the far future. And that matches what we studied last time, right? What we studied last time was, in that day, there'll be a song being sung in the land of Judah. And this is about the Lord and being visited and then, you know, the remnant and taking refuge. And it had very much a discussion of the end times. And so what have we done, really, in Isaiah up to 27 so far? We've really worked through sort of the history with all the surrounding areas, sort of the ideas of all the people that have kind of come up to either be partners with or be enemies of, you know, the people of God. We've dealt with all that. And now we've made our way forward to the end times. So God is basically explaining that you have all this trouble. You have this trouble now. You had this trouble before. You have this trouble coming. But there's going to be this day coming, and in that day, these things are going to happen. This city on a hill, this reestablishment of Jerusalem. Just hilarious, because he's in Jerusalem, in a very powerful position, in a very powerful country, talking about when Jerusalem comes back. It hasn't been destroyed yet. So there's all this prophetic nature of everything, and we'll get more of that next time. As we make our way through the first half of Isaiah, where we're dealing with all these problems. And of course, he's hinting continuously at the solution. And the solution, of course, is coming. He's going to talk more about in the coming chapters all the problems. But there's going to be an answer, and we know the answer, and that's Jesus. And so we'll have the full glory of Jesus. Once we get to the full glory of Jesus being revealed, which we're getting all these hints as we go, then we'll switch gears back into sort of a historical look, because we have to get to back to our story at hand, you know, when the Assyrians are still coming, right? And they're still going to try to take out Jerusalem. So all this is kind of keep all this in your head in this kind of framework. I know it's hard. There's a whole lot going on. And Isaiah's language is so beautiful and well written, but it doesn't make it easy. It doesn't make it easy to understand. He doesn't do 1, 2, 3. Here's the story in order. And he's skipping around. I think he's skipping around in his own head. I think he's seeing and hearing things. And he's like, I'm writing it down because I'm faithful. But I don't know how much he understood about all this stuff. I mean, he's familiar with, like, for instance, the Euphrates River. But what it has to do with anything, I don't have any idea how much he knows about the rat. He knows who what Babylon is. Babylon existed as a very powerful kingdom in the past. It's going to exist again as a very powerful kingdom. He seems to know that, but no one else does. Babylon's over when he's living. But here it comes again. I mean, it's very strange. But we'll get back to some more like what's happening at the time that he's there in a few chapters from now. But right now we're dealing with how this all gets resolved. Any questions? I know we're like, man. Any questions about any of that? We're gonna keep going. Like I said, there's 66 chapters. That was chapter 27. We're making great progress. So 2025 should be finishing up. We'll have a quiz. There'll be a quiz at the end of this, so I hope you're paying attention. But anyway, okay, let's pray. Lord, I like blink and our time is over, and we're so grateful to have this time together and have you with us, just showing us your word, and we're just so grateful for this place to meet and for the ability to talk about your word and try to learn from it. Please keep helping us understand. Please keep opening our hearts and our minds to see more of you. Thank you so much for this week of Thanksgiving, for our families and our friends and our church and our lives and all the blessings you've bestowed upon us. We worship your holy name, Lord. We love you so much and depend on you for everything. Just have your way in our lives. We want to show you all the gratitude and thanks that we can, because everything we have is from you. All the good things in our lives are from you. Please bless and protect everyone here. Keep us safe as we travel. Keep our families and our finances and our jobs and our health secure in your arms, surrounded by your protection. Bless us and protect us mightily, Lord. And everyone that would be here, if they could or is connected to us in any way, please bless and protect them. Keep them safe on their travels. And bless this day and the message we have. Bring people in, have their hearts touched. Lord, touch them and show them your greatness and who you are. Thank you for this time, and keep blessing us with it. We love you so much. We pray all these things in the mighty and unstoppable name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Isaiah.